own right confused. But those two issues, the consent calendar and the Pacific Connector easement, would you just, oh, we are just about, we've got a minute left. If you can just clarify those two terms for listeners, the consent calendar and this easement.
Well, when commissioners put something on the consent calendar, it's not up for discussion. It's just they approve the consent calendar and that those items are approved. And what they did is they put an easement for Pacific Connector on the consent calendar. That means there was no public, it was not up for public discussion. It's very frustrating what's going on with some of our elected officials. They're not representing the public interest. They're not even really looking out for future interest. Nothing. People have got to start paying attention.
On that note, too, we have to go. But county elected representatives putting a done deal on a calendar that can't be changed. It's going on our watch, right in front of us, just when we thought it was safe to go back to the beach. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, April 4th. Engineering today, Kate Welch. Thanks, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOOM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Inner City Blues Festival's Healing the Healthcare Blues on Saturday, April 16th from 6 p.m. to midnight at the North Portland Eagles Lodge in Portland. The campaign for universal healthcare for every citizen is growing around the United States. Our local organization, Healthcare for All Oregon, has brought the movement to the stage for an outreach and fundraising mega concert featuring Vicki Stevens and the True Blue Lady Cat, Rosalind Hunters with LaRonda Steele, Terry Robb, Norman Sylvester Band, and many more. KBOO will be broadcasting live from the event. Again, that's Healing the Healthcare Blues on Saturday, April 16th from 6 p.m. to midnight at the North Portland Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Pressure continues to turn the Pacific Northwest into a hub for fossil fuel exports. Yet opponents of these proposed refineries, pipelines, and export terminals have managed to stop or slow the progress of several of these projects. This morning, Eric DePlace and Nick Abraham with Sightline Institute in Seattle return to the show to give us an update on the victories and challenges facing the movement to prevent the Northwest from becoming another sacrifice zone for the fossil fuel industry. Eric is Sightline's policy director and Nick is a Sightline fellow. Eric and Nick, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having us back, Barbara. It's good to see you. Eric, good to talk to you again, Barbara.
Hi, both of you. Well, there's been several victories for opponents of fossil fuel development in the Northwest over the last few weeks. And I wanted to start by talking about the most recent, I thought it was a victory until I read an article by you, Nick, but I want to talk about what's going on in Coos Bay area, North Bend, on the South Oregon coast with the LNG proposed export terminal and pipeline. A few weeks ago, we heard the news that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission had turned down the permit for the pipeline and thereby also turning down the permit for the terminal as well. But then, Nick, you wrote an article that I saw which threw a lot of cold water on people's excitement and joy. So I want to talk about a little bit about the decision on FERC's part to deny the permit and then what's happened in the ensuing week. So I'll start with Nick, have you talk a little bit about what you wrote about in your article.
Sure. So like you were saying, Jordan Cove just had this big decision brought down by FERC, and I would say it was a big victory. I did throw a big bucket of cold water on a lot of people's assessment of it, I think, but I do think it's a big move for citizens that have been fighting it, landowners that have been staunchly against this project. What happened with the project was, they hadn't secured any contracts or funding to purchase the natural gas from Jordan Cove. And that was a big reason why FERC ended up denying the permit. They cited all these reasons like landowner opposition, it would be the largest single source of pollution in the state of Oregon built. There was water rights and contamination issues, but the major reason that they said those trumped the project was because they hadn't shown that there was any interest or funding or support for the project. Just a few weeks after that announcement, they secured a big contract for 1.8 of the 6 billion gallons of natural gas.
Now, who's they?
The company that they signed with is a Japanese energy kind of conglomerate, and they, it's a non-binding agreement because they still don't have those permits and the project hasn't been built yet. But I think, and what I was trying to show in that article is that this shows that there is possible purchasing parties out there that they could work with, and that they're mostly that Jordan Cove is not going away. They don't see the FERC decision as the final say. They want to keep trying to push for this project to go through.
So what does it say overall? Do you feel like there were too many loopholes in the FERC decision, or is it that it's just really hard to put a damper on the last dying gasp of the fossil fuel industry as they try to continue to maintain the status quo?
So I do think Jordan Cove is on the ropes, and I think this is definitely seeing them taking some big swings, knowing that they're really close to having this project be completely gone. FERC, in the past, in general, is pretty quick to give out permits. It's an agency that has been scrutinized for being too lenient with industry. So for this decision to come down is actually pretty impressive for them not to have given this permit despite all the opposition. But I think it shows overall is that these project backers are not going to give up the fight, and that they're going to keep clawing at it no matter what, and that people need to stay vigilant when these projects are coming through, that even when decisions come down, they need to keep their eye on the ball and make sure that these guys really go away.
Now, what do you think this foretells about the other big natural liquid natural gas proposal in Oregon, which is the one near Astoria, Oregon LNG? What's the state of that? What's its status at this point?
They're still going through the permitting process. I haven't heard a lot of news from them recently, but I know that this sets a precedent that if you don't have secured funding, if you don't have people that are already backing your project before you get permits, that there's going to be so much community opposition and so much brought to the table that shows that these projects can be so damaging that if you don't have that money in hand, there's a very big likelihood that they could deny your permit.
Well, one of the concerns that you raised in your article, and you sort of alluded to it just now, is despite the fact that FERC did cite pollution issues, landowner opposition, other safety concerns, that the factor that trumped the proposal for FERC was really the fact that they hadn't secured the buyers for the LNG, that so it wasn't financially feasible. Are you concerned that FERC is still looking at financial feasibility as the major factor, whether they're going to approve a permit or not, and that these other environmental issues and safety issues that are at the forefront of community concerns are not as much of a concern to FERC?
I think it's something they've been that's something that a lot of people have raised in the past with FERC, that they're far too quick to give out permits. And I think there hasn't been as organized opposition to a lot of these projects before as well. So I think it can be laid on both sides, that FERC's been a little too lenient, and that the community hasn't made their voice heard as strongly as they have recently. The opposition from these projects, you know, this is a small town in Southern Oregon that's based around fishing and shipping, and it's an old lumber city. And the communities that have come up against it in Southern Oregon, along the pipeline route and in the city, have shown unprecedented organization and really making their voice heard. So I think it's probably caught the company a little off guard, and FERC off guard as well, that they haven't seen this type of outcry for projects like this.
Well, what's interesting to me is until a couple of years ago, a lot of attention up here was focused on the proposed LNG terminal outside of Astoria, the one that predates the Oregon LNG, which is the current proposal. And that got a huge amount of press and a lot of action and protests, and people mobilized and people knew about it. And it got stopped through all the opposition. And meanwhile, Jordan Cove just kept teetering along, and it seemed like it didn't matter how much Jody McCafferty and the other activists down there fought, nobody was paying attention. So what do you think tipped it so that now Jordan Cove is getting the kind of attention that the Astoria projects were getting all along?
You know, there's been a widespread movement to sort of link all these projects together. The thin green line is what Sightline calls it, and Eric has done a lot of work getting this movement out there, that all these projects are connected, that the entire region is fighting these as a single organized unit, and that, you know, whether it's methanol, whether it's coal, whether it's oil, whether it's these LNG projects, they're all on the same vein of stopping new fossil fuel infrastructure. So I think the reason Jordan Cove, and the reason some of these smaller projects in these sort of more less populated areas, the reason they're still coming up and the reason that people are still paying attention to them as strongly as some of these places that are in, you know, Tacoma and that are in Bellingham and they're in Portland, is because of this sort of solidarity movement to try and link all these projects together.
Well, I want to bring Eric into the conversation now, and let's move on from LNG to methanol. We'll do that later. I move on to the oil refinery that was proposed for Longview, and that was the other kind of interesting story that broke at the end of February. So, Eric, let's talk a bit about what that refinery was going to be for and what's happened to it.
Yeah, so that was one of the most curious projects we've seen in this big wave of fossil fuel proposals over the last few years. At Longview, we actually had two projects proposed side by side. One was a small oil refinery that would have taken about two-thirds of the feedstock was Bakken shale oil shipped in by train. The other one-third of the feedstock for that refinery would have been internationally sourced biofuel that was left unspecified, presumably palm oil from Southeast Asia. And then next door to that was a propane by rail facility that was supposed to take in fairly large quantities of propane trains, unload that, and then store them in tanks. And so together, these two projects, this kind of weird hybridized quote-unquote biorefinery and then this propane by rail facility, were sort of two separate projects in theory, but they shared the same project backers and the same they kind of stumbled through the process. And Longview just rejected that the proposal for the refinery, which is the one that the proposal that was moving a little bit faster. The Port Commission voted unanimously against it. So that's we've sort of seen various versions and configurations of this stuff come up over the last few years, but this one at Longview was a really curious kind of multi-headed beast, and it seems now to have gone away. But, you know, I would expect it to crop up in some other form somewhere else. It's kind of the nature of these beasts right now.
Well, I was reviewing some articles you wrote last summer about this refinery and how curious it was. And I hadn't remembered that it was supposedly a alternative energy or renewable energy refinery. And so that, it, at least according to some news reports, it was engendering more support from the environmental community than a typical oil refinery would. In your article, you point out that there's some equivocation about just how renewable the energy was. So what were some of the concerns last summer? Why did it have any support at all from environmentalists, or did it? And what were some of the concerns about it being not really a very benign force?
Yeah, you know, it's let me back up from that once, maybe a half step, and say what we're seeing now from the fossil fuel industry is, as they are realizing that they can't get their projects built in the Northwest, they're starting to change the way they talk about the projects. And what we're seeing now with virtually every single new project that's being proposed is they're coming in and saying, hey, look, this is actually a clean energy solution. This is a way to promote renewable energy. This is part of the, this is a climate solution. So they're really starting to sing our song in that way. As it turns out, it's mostly just fiction that they're spinning, but they are starting to use that language, and it has had some effectiveness in the sense that it gets people to pause long enough and scratch their heads and say, well, it doesn't look like it's, you know, at first blush as bad as coal or as bad as oil, so maybe this really is some sort of transitional project that will help us bridge out of the really dirtiest forms of fossil fuels into something cleaner. That notion tends to fall apart under scrutiny and analysis, but they really have been coming in with that, singing that song, and it was true at Longview for sure. It's been true to a degree with the methanol projects that we've seen crop up recently, and it's true with some of these other strange sort of petrochemical projects that are around the region.
Well, when they say that it was going to be renewable fuel, actually, before we get into this, I just want to let people know that if you just tune in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. My guests this morning are Eric DePlace and Nick Abraham with Flatline Institute, and we're getting updated on the latest status of the battle between the fossil fuel industry and those who want to have a clean, green, sustainable Pacific Northwest. And we're talking right now about probably not that well-known an issue in Longview, Washington, where there was a proposal for an oil refinery that got torpedoed at the end of February by the actual Port Commission of Longview, a new step for Port to take, actually, which we can get to that, too. So what were some of the issues with them claiming that this was a renewable fuel that they were producing at this refinery, or they were going to produce?
Right. Well, so part of the reason that they appear to have made that argument is so that they would maybe garner some support from the governor's office or from some of the environmental community who have been looking for a way to meet low-carbon fuel standards, that's the renewable fuel standards that will eventually make the gasoline in our cars have a lower carbon profile. And so they were trying to sort of use the slipstream of those policies and position themselves as a part of that solution to reduce the carbon intensity of the transportation fuel that we use. Now, that doesn't appear to be sort of factually accurate at all, because what they were really proposing to do, of course, is bring in fracked shale oil from North Dakota, bring that in on trains, and then take presumably palm oil, though they never specified that, in on vessels, blend them together, and then sell that to either Oregon or Washington, or probably both, as a way to meet those low-carbon fuel standards. There was never, like with most of these projects, there's never, they sort of make these claims, but they're really just sort of substanceless marketing claims that don't have any sort of analytical depth behind them. It's just what they're doing is they've got an idea to take advantage of the Northwest geography to export or to otherwise handle or process fossil fuels. And then they start using the language of whatever the environmental policy of the day is here. And so that's basically what we saw with this one. But, it did have the effect of initially getting some of the big campaigns to pause long enough to kind of scratch their heads. We have, a very robust anti-coal campaign. We have a very robust campaign against oil by rail. What they were trying to do was introduce some complexity into that and get folks to pause. Ultimately, it wasn't an effective strategy for them. And I think folks were able to fairly quickly see through it. And certainly, the big advocacy groups in Southwest Washington and that, sort of Portland, Lower Columbia region in Oregon went to war against the project at Longview and chalked up yet another victory.
Well, what are some of the problems with palm oil? I mean, which it seems a little bit extreme to be importing palm oil from Indonesia to bring it all the way up to the Pacific Northwest to convert it to, or to use that as an additive to make a quote renewable fuel. But why are people so opposed to palm oil?
Well, it's associated. I mean, the reason that it sort of first came to light as a problematic fuel source is that it's been associated with so much deforestation in Southeast Asia. And you know, if you've ever had the opportunity to go and look at some of those palm oil plantations, it's really pretty staggering. They're cutting down very productive primary rainforest there and planting it up with these massive monocultures of palm oil, using very questionable labor practices to harvest that stuff as well. But then it gets worse because the carbon accounting for it actually looks very poor. It actually, from a carbon perspective, by any sort of reasonable analysis of what those palm oil plantations look like, it's actually worse than conventional oil.
Why is that? Why is the carbon accounting so skewed?
Well, when you cut down a rainforest like that, you're releasing a tremendous amount of carbon into the atmosphere, both from the soil where a lot of that carbon is sequestered, and then also from the biological material in the rainforest. But then also by the time that you actually plant those trees, harvest the palm oil, process it, and then ship it across the ocean, certainly, you're adding carbon at every step of that way. And it's actually, I think most folks now agree that when you kind of do that math and hold it up next to just the carbon embedded in conventional crude oil, it's actually probably better to just take the conventional crude. So it's only if you kind of do a very one-eyed accounting of the carbon profile of that palm oil later on in the process that you might want to try to qualify it as a renewable or low carbon fuel source.
And there's also the issue with all those forest fires in Indonesia too, which are, I understand are also started by as part of burning. They cut down and then burn these slash piles and they get out of control and then they have these raging wildfires.
That's right. And you can see satellite imagery of these just absolutely titanic forest fires that are drifting, where the smoke is drifting across. Very large part of that region there. I was actually in Singapore once when we were, you were just practically choking on the forest fire smoke that was drifting all the way across the Straits of Malacca from Sumatra. So a tremendous environmental impact there from those sorts of practices. And it's a real tragedy that's still ongoing today. And it's one of those curious ways where these projects in the Northwest were kind of reaching out and having at least some connection to things that were going on way overseas.
Well, why do you think the Port of Longview decided to vote against? Actually, they unanimously denied the permit for this refinery. Why was that?
Well, so they actually said at the time that it was not a vote about fossil fuels, but which I don't know if I completely believe them, but what they said was that they thought this was a raw deal for Longview. And I think that's right. And they weren't seeing that this was that the project backers were serious, that they had the credibility to be able to run a project like this, which is probably true. But they also, when you start looking at the purported economic benefits for these projects, they very often they're paper thin claims and they tend to fall apart. I am of the belief that we need to oppose these projects because it is a way for us to chart a new course away from fossil fuels. It's a way for us to advance a climate protection scheme. But also, I would point out that the economics for these projects are usually very poor. They're very poor for the region, and they're often very poor for localities. And so in a place like Longview, when the Port Commission and others start to really study, what are the costs and benefits of a project like this? What are the trade-offs? It turns out that it's a pretty raw deal for them, too. They're tying up a bunch of port land with something that's likely a risky, volatile venture. It's not producing that many jobs. And then there are all of these risks associated with it, including oil spills, propane train derailments, and on and on and on. So it's hard for them to sort of say, well, this is actually a good economic development strategy for us. It just doesn't work out that way.
Well, have there been any other port commissions that have voted down projects like this besides the Longview Port?
Well, curiously enough, actually, Longview had voted down a previous propane project called Haven Energy, and that happened, I guess about a year or so ago, just before Portland rejected its propane project. So that's one example. But for the most part, no. Four commissions have been all too willing to go along with leasing land to these projects, often with very little understanding of what's at stake. And so we haven't yet seen very many of the ports sort of reject or back away from these proposals. I think that's coming in the near future. I mean, we're seeing citizens get a lot more engaged in the fact, in sort of recognizing that their ports are public entities. They elect the port commissioners to those roles. And as we're seeing port commissions become more political, they're starting to become more representative of their constituents. And what that will mean, I think, is a greater tendency for them to reject these kinds of projects.
Well, have we seen that anyplace else besides in Vancouver, Washington?
Well, we're starting to see it in Tacoma to a large degree. There's a lot of heat going on in Tacoma over this giant methanol refinery, the largest methanol refinery in the world by a long shot, that's been proposed for the Tide Flats area. That's the industrial part of Tacoma. We have not seen the actual election like we saw in Vancouver, which was the most expensive port race by far in the history of Vancouver, Washington. But stuff is brewing in Tacoma in a big way. We did in Seattle see a contested and hot race, a very expensive race also for our port commission here. That was in the aftermath of the Seattle port deciding to host the Shell Arctic drilling rigs here. That was an extremely unpopular decision, and largely on the basis of that controversy, voters in Seattle elected a guy named Fred Fellman to the port commission in the last election. So that is one other example of that happening.
So he's also like the new port commissioner in Vancouver. He is much more critical of these projects than the status quo port commissioners.
That's right. In Vancouver, Washington, a guy named Eric LeBrant has been very critical of the oil by rail projects and doesn't see oil as a viable future for the Port of Vancouver. Fred Fellman in Seattle has a multi-decade history of working to protect Puget Sound and on behalf of the tribes to protect their fishing rights and other things. So he's been an antagonist of the Puget Sound oil industry for his whole career, really.
Well, let's move on to methanol, which you mentioned. I'm not sure, maybe Nick wants to jump in on this too. The methanol proposal that is getting the most heat down here south of the Columbia River is the one in Kalama, which isn't that far from us. But let's talk about that project and the Tacoma project and any other methanol projects that are popping up around the region.
Yeah, so I'll start off and then maybe Nick can chime in a second. So what these are large-scale projects to take in fracked natural gas, build new pipeline infrastructure, deliver it to a refinery, and then refine that natural gas into methanol, which is a liquid petrochemical that you can use for a whole bunch of different things. You can use it as fuel for transportation, but these particular projects are being proposed for plastics manufacturing in China. There's one project backer, it's the Chinese government, it's an arm of the Chinese government, and they have proposed these three refineries. The biggest one in the world by a long shot would be in Tacoma, then one about half that size at Kalama on the lower Columbia River. That's the fastest moving project of the three right now, and then one at Port Westward on the Oregon side of the Columbia, which is the slowest moving of those projects. That has become enormously controversial in Tacoma right now, and we're starting to see now in Kalama, as the methanol refinery there goes up for public review, a lot of activity and controversy around the wisdom of citing a project like that at Kalama.
So what kind of impact would these projects have on the communities? I mean, we're aware of the massive impact of the largest oil export hub in North America being proposed for Vancouver. We understand the enormous implications of the LNG terminals being proposed in Astoria and in Jordan Cove at Coos Bay. What kind of impact does methanol have, and how does that compare to having oil trains and oil terminals and pipelines and all the other infrastructure that goes along with these other proposals that are receiving so much opposition?
Yeah, I mean, it's always difficult to make a strictly apples-to-apples comparison. I mean, liquefied natural gas is extremely dangerous if mishandled. Methanol is probably less dangerous, but that's setting a pretty low bar. So you've got to build a new pipeline infrastructure that's going to take in natural gas. That's got its own risk profile associated with it, its own harms to property owners and potentially to the environment. Then you're going to be creating a big petrochemical that's going to use a ton of water and produce wastewater and produce some emissions. And methanol itself, if spilled, is highly toxic. It is highly flammable. And you know, at the end of the day, you know, let's say you can operate all that stuff safely. You can move it. You can move tankers down the Columbia River safely. Let's say that's all possible. You don't have any spills. Let's say, you know, at the end of the day, you're employing a relatively small number of people in a place like Kalama, and the whole purpose of that is to basically export raw commodities in the form of, you know, natural gas and water, produced, you know, processed into methanol, and then shipped to China so that they can make cheaper plastics. And you know, while those projects have been billed as a clean energy solution, it's allegedly a cleaner way of making plastics. That those claims have sort of fallen apart under scrutiny, and it turns out that it's probably not a cleaner way of making plastics; it's just a cheaper way of making plastics.
What is methanol exactly? How do they make it from methane or from natural gas?
Yeah, so it is a liquid petrochemical. We have typically known it as wood alcohol because that's how it used to be made. It's a relatively simple compound, but it's historically been made from coal or from naphtha, which is a oil refining product. That's how it's typically made in China now. There's sort of new processes in place that allow them to basically take natural gas, which is mostly composed of methane, run it over some heavy metal catalysts, and then by using some electricity with the catalyst, and I don't exactly understand the whole sort of chemistry of the projects, together with water, they're able to produce this methanol, which is a liquid at atmospheric temperature, although it is highly flammable.
So it's like a form of alcohol?
It's a form of alcohol. That's right. Yeah, it's simple alcohol.
So I wanted to bring, actually, I want to let people know that you are listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. We're talking this morning with Eric DePlace and Nick Abraham with Sightline Institute, and we're talking about different proposals for developing petrochemical infrastructure here in the Pacific Northwest and a lot of the opposition that these projects are facing. I want to bring Nick back in. I don't know what your thoughts are about methanol, if that's something that you've been following as much as you've been following the LNG issues, but what are you thinking about all this?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things about this project, the refinery we mentioned earlier, and to a large extent, the Tesoro oil by rail project in Vancouver, is this shift in language and the way they're trying to frame these that Eric alluded to earlier. They've gotten stymied at every stop trying to push these as job creators and oil projects. But now that they've come out and tried to say that this is a climate solution, that these are green projects, that they're shifting and sort of obfuscating the math and showing that, look, this actually produces less emissions, they've really caused like a pause and a shift and a change in sort of the political calculus of these projects. But whenever we've gotten into the actual details, whenever we've taken off that initial layer that they've put on there arbitrarily as calling the projects green, they never hold up to that scrutiny. It's just a shift to try and use the region's own identity against itself. Everyone sort of knows the brand of the Northwest is built on this environmental sustainability about trying to take care of the region. So when they use that language, they're really just trying to use what we in the Northwest identify ourselves as against us to try and push these projects through.
So how do you do the research to figure out what they're really doing when they are claiming that they are going to be producing this renewable energy?
Well, I'll give you one example. Tesoro down in Vancouver is trying to build what would be the largest oil by rail project in North America. And as a part of that project, they put out a statewide mailer that touted the green benefits of the project. They were basically showing that in comparison to other types of oil, it was using less, it would produce less emissions. They cited all these really impressive groups like the Washington Department of Ecology, the California Air Resources Board, and the Carnegie Institute. And, you know, it looked like they had legitimate claims. But when we went back and we called these groups and we asked them about the information they were cited in, they had no idea they'd been cited. They completely refuted the claims, and they asked that they be retracted. And that was that got a decent amount of press around Washington State. But there's sort of no bounds to how willing they are to misrepresent research and misrepresent what the actual facts are.
Well, you earlier mentioned the thin green line, that I guess that's a term that Eric coined a while back to describe what this region is. So let's talk a little bit more about what that means and how that's coming into play as these proposals come to the table, and it seems like one by one are getting knocked off the table.
Yeah, I mean, the genesis behind that line was this idea that, or behind that phrase, is that the Pacific Northwest is unique in the sense that it is pinched between these huge reserves of fossil fuels, these huge carbon reserves in the interior of North America, and the fastest growing energy markets in Asia. And for all sorts of reasons that have to do with kind of the geography and the economics of moving these products, if the fossil fuel industry cannot get infrastructure between Coos Bay, Oregon, and Prince Rupert, British Columbia, and that little sliver of coast, then that stuff's going to stay in the ground. And so that's why we've seen dozens of proposals for coal exports and oil by rail and propane and methanol and liquefied natural gas, is because the only natural markets for that stuff, to a degree, are on the opposite side of the Pacific. And so the Pacific Northwest is in this really interesting kind of inflection point where the region is either going to become kind of a Gulf Coast on the Pacific and be steamrolled by the fossil fuel industry, or it's going to act like what I call the thin green line, that's going to say no and reject all of these projects, and in doing so chart a much cleaner course, not only for itself but for the world in terms of global climate emissions. So that's kind of why I call it the thin green line, because there's so much pressure and so much opportunity for this region. And it is worth saying that we're running the table on the fossil fuel industry right now. There's not one single project that has faced an opposition movement that has been able to proceed so far. So I think there's every reason for the region to believe that no matter how big and ferocious these projects look, there's no reason to believe that they can't be beaten, because history is showing, recent history is showing, that they all can be beaten.
Well, are there any projects that have not faced opposition that are going forward?
There were a small number of existing refineries on Puget Sound that were able to get oil by rail loops, that is, like some minimal infrastructure built to allow them to receive oil trains. Those projects got built before people were really aware of what was going on. But those are really the only counterexamples to what I'm talking about. We've seen two big oil pipelines in British Columbia that have faced tremendous amounts of opposition that have then stalled. Now they continue to be stalled. It looks like at least one of them is going to be dead for sure. The other one is getting more and more questionable. Same thing with the coal export terminal. Same thing with all the oil by rail projects that have come online afterward, or tried to come online afterward. And so you can kind of go through this, and we're talking about several dozen projects. There's just no good news for the fossil fuel industry in there.
Well, there's, in a way, all this fossil fuel development proposals feel a bit like a game of whack-a-mole, that it's because you fight one, you get it, you knock it down, then another one pops up somewhere else. But I'm also wondering if there's maybe not more of a case of synergy, where the more these proposals are come on the table, the more they're going to be fought and the more the opposition organizes.
That's definitely how I think about it. I mean, we have seen unprecedented engagement in civic affairs, actually. I mean, not just about environmental issues, but we are setting records for public attendance, or for attendance at public meetings in counties and cities all over this region. And so, what has happened is that as we have fought now, we're into sort of the third wave of a tsunami, coal, oil, and now these kind of fracked fuels and petrochemicals, that we're seeing the opposition movement grow and become stronger and more robust. And I think that spillover into larger progressive politics and larger environmental issues is potentially very profound. So in a way, we should credit the fossil fuel industry for kicking off a regeneration of civic engagement in the Pacific Northwest, because what's happening is, and just by the numbers, in a really objective way, is just astonishing.
Well, what kind of interests me, I'm doing this documentary now about this issue, and I've been talking to a number of folks who are opposing the Vancouver oil terminal proposal, and I'm trying to set up interviews with them, and it turns out I can't do it on the second and the fourth Tuesdays of the month, because that's when the port Commission meets. And I'm just the more I talk to these people, the more I got the sense of what these Port Commission meetings are like. And they sound like they're packed with opponents. In fact, I'm going to go to my first one next week and see it for myself. But who would have thought a few years ago that, you know, twice a month that hundreds of people go to the Port Commission meetings?
Exactly. I think that's a great example of that. And it's in Vancouver, it's in Tacoma, it's in Grace Harbor, it's in, you know, all of these places where, you know, it, we used to see Port Commission's meeting that, you know, there was a reporter in the back falling asleep and, you know, and then one cranky old guy maybe. There was just nobody there. And now it's the opposite. Every seat is filled at these meetings. And everybody's paying attention to these things. And I think that's got to be, you know, on net very, very positive for the Pacific Northwest. As we start to realize that we have control, we as citizens, as voters, as constituents, we have a lot of say in how our cities and our ports grow and develop. And, you know, we are not victims. It is very much in our control. So I look forward to your reporting on that experience. I expect it will be an interesting one.
Yeah, I look forward to trying to figure out how to record it. That's always the biggest challenge. I've recorded a few hearings so far, and it's the audio is very hard to get because they're not really set up for people to come and they don't have the press feeds that more polished places do. Well, I was thinking about how port commissions, in my mind, used to be kind of, at least here in the Northwest, they kind of like with the weather, like they were like the weather, that you really couldn't change them. You expected them to represent everything you were opposed to come up with projects that you just looked like they'd be really bad for the community, that they were soaking in money and just losing it somewhere, and there was no way to change it. And I think I only realized recently that these poor commissioners are being elected, and I learned this through what's going on in Vancouver with the oil terminal. So I wonder if this is like a new renaissance where we understand that the Port Commission will suddenly become one of the more importantly focused governing bodies in our region, in the same way like the Metro Council in the Portland area, which was a sleepy little council when it first started, and then it became one of the most contentious government bodies in the state.
Yeah, I definitely think Eric's absolutely right about this. Port Commission races are becoming the unignorable ballot. You know, whenever we were looking at our ballots, you know, there's about four that people cared about, and then there's a whole bunch at the end that nobody paid attention to. And all of a sudden, these Port Commission races are becoming a referendum on these projects. You mentioned Eric LeBrant, the new Vancouver Port Commissioner. We talked about the Seattle race, and it's really become a flashpoint for people to make their voices heard and understand that if people let these projects go through, if they're not in opposition, they're going to be killed at the ballot.
So, in the many minutes that we have, are there any other projects or issues on the horizon that people should be paying attention to and being prepared to come out and support or oppose?
You know, it's funny. Every time we talk to you, it seems like something just happened. There's a couple things that are developing in this last week that are really interesting. So, in Grace Harbor, there was originally three oil by rail projects. REG went down last year. They decided that they were not going to pursue it and are going to focus on renewables. And U.S. Development just announced a few days ago that they just allowed their lease to expire. They were paying about $21,000 a month for it to try and keep that process going, and they just decided to let it run through, so they're not going to pursue that in Grace Harbor at all. There's still one more oil by rail terminal that could be built there, the Westway project, but the other two have gone down, and it says a lot about how that community's come up against it.
So any others that are popping up that we need to be watching out for? Just like a year ago, we were concerned about there being the Pembina liquid propane terminal being built here in Portland, which had a very short half-life. But are there any things on the horizon that people should be looking out for and being ready to oppose?
I think the ones that are sort of coming down the pike would be methanol on the Columbia River. You know, in the Portland area, there's this one at Kalama that's now up for public review, plus potentially one at Port Westward near Clatskanie. That will be coming up a little bit later on. Folks who are in the Puget Sound region should be paying attention to Soro's project in Anacortes. They want to build a xylene extraction unit, which is a way of making petrochemicals at that refinery, as well as refining crude oil. Those are the two newest ones, or the two newest types of xylene and methanol. In terms of other stuff cropping up, nothing that we know of yet, but I'm sure there will be, there may be more to come.
Well, next week I'm going to have Dan Sears from Columbia Riverkeeper on, and we're going to be talking in particular about the oil terminal proposal in Vancouver, because there's a deadline coming up for hearings.
Right.
So that's one thing we'll keep. That's why we didn't talk about it today, because we're going to focus on that next week.
Mm-hmm.
It's always good to have you guys on. We'll probably check back in a couple months and see how the news has shifted.
Yeah, well, great, Barbara. Thanks for having us again.
Sure, thanks a whole lot.
Appreciate it. Good talking to you.
Sure. We've been talking this morning with Eric DePlace and Nick Abraham with Sightline Institute in Seattle, and you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locustfocus. And I understand that really soon all of our programming is going to be available for podcast on iTunes, so I'm real excited about that. And as I said before, next week we'll continue the discussion about oil pressure on the Northwest with Dan Sears with the Columbia Riverkeeper, and he'll talk about the latest efforts to stop the proposed oil terminal in Vancouver. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go with some music by The Band. Thanks for listening.
And good morning. It is 11 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. And coming up next is Health Watch. Today, Dr. David Naiman speaks with Dr. Kelly Brogan about her new book, A Mind of Your Own, and about the myths regarding depression. Then you'll want to stay tuned at 11:30 on Madness Radio. Host Will Hall. He speaks with neurologist Dr. Raymond Tallis, philosopher at the Academy of Medical Sciences, about the bad science and faulty logic behind pop obsessions and the brain and evolutionary psychology. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Smoldering Fires, produced by Passenart. The play runs from March 11th through April 10th at the Interstate Firehouse.